Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Verlin Brown, who will be speaking on men as success objects. So let's listen in on Verlin Brown.
This session is called Men as Success Objects. Number one in a series of four. I've been reading up on this subject for quite some time, and two books that that a lot of this comes from. One is called, I mentioned today, by Warren Farrell, and the book is called Why Men Are the Way They Are. And he wrote that in about 83. It's in soft cover, and it's in the bookstore. He wrote his latest one in 84, I mean in 94, and it's a hard cover. It's also in the bookstore, and it's called The Myth of Male Power. And that's where the bulk of the material comes from, but I've been reading all sorts of books, so I throw in all kinds of things from different books that I've read that pertains to this subject. But if you're interested in the bulk of the material, that's where it comes from. I'll give you a little info on a little bio on Warren Farrell. Warren Farrell was married to a woman who was a ranking officer in National Association of Women's now. And he was the only male member of now. And he wrote a couple of books on what Robert Bly would call soft male issues, a lot of feeling stuff. And
soft male issues?
Yeah, and how men should relate to women and that sort of stuff. And then his wife dumped him, and he got pissed off, and he wrote these other two books. So that's just kind of a brief little history of Warren Farrell.
Did he drop out of now? Did he drop out of now?
He dropped out of now when he wrote his first book. Now got pissed at him, and so they're mad at him, and he's mad at his wife. And so it's just kind of a big mess, but he's making money. Which is, you know, it sounds like part of the reason why his wife dumped him, because she was a corporate worker, and she worked for a large corporation, and he was a struggling writer, and she made more money than him. And then when she dumped him, she got involved with a higher up exec who made much more money than Farrell has ever seen. And so now, you know, he sort of got back at her with these books that are selling quite well. I would like to mention that I expect this to be a safe place, and I will do that as facilitator as best I can to make sure that there is no shaming, blaming, or bashing. And if I feel like we're getting dangerously close to that, I'll try to make sure that we stop it. Robert Bly, who wrote Iron John, says that men and women have this incredible ability to shame one another and to silence one another. So let's hope and work at keeping the lines of communication open and not shutting anybody down. I have this idea, you know, you have to do things for people to get to know each other. Let's ask a question. Is there anybody in here who feels like they don't need any money?
Any money?
Okay, good. Then I would like for you to turn to the people around you and ask for money. Whatever you need, you think you need money for. If you need money for an ice cream cone tonight, ask for that. If you think you need help with your mortgage, ask for that. But for the next 5 minutes, introduce yourself to people and ask for money. Okay? How many people ask more than three people? So I'm taking it Who didn't ask at all?
We did sort of.
You did sort of. Who asked one person? And was that person somebody you knew?
No.
No? Okay.
That's we got sidetracked.
Okay. How did it feel to ask for money?
Awkward.
Awkward?
Yeah.
Okay, I can't spell, so forgive me.
A-W-K-W-A-R-D.
Okay, awkward. Thank you. Help me out when I need it. What other feelings do people have about asking for money?
I know they're going to turn me down.
You know they're going to turn
rejection.
You down?
Rejection.
Okay. Asking for rejection here.
Okay. Rejection. What else?
Embarrassment.
Yeah, embarrassment?
Yes.
How do you spell that word?
E-M-B-A-R.
ASSMND.
2 hours.
2 hours.
2 hours. What other feelings did people have?
It didn't seem realistic to me, and I made a joke about it till you said to be serious, and then I didn't have anything to ask for.
Okay, so you made a joke of it. All right. Any other feelings?
Personal feeling is that I feel that I should earn it myself as opposed to ask for it.
Okay. Oh, noble person in your room.
Humble.
More so now.
Humble?
I felt like I was saying something about myself. It was like self-revelations. What I want to spend money on is telling somebody who I am.
Okay.
We discovered that.
Okay. Any other feelings?
There are power issues going on to ask for money.
Power issues?
Yeah.
In what?
Giving is powerful, and asking feels like you could be giving up some of it.
Okay.
The withholding is even more powerful.
Okay. I'll just put power issues. Any more feelings about it?
I would feel like I was putting the other person on the spot.
Okay.
I'll just put spot.
How many people feel like it's a dumb game and they didn't participate much at all? Some realistic people are here. Okay, let me get to the point of this of a money game here. This is a way to understand men. Money is something that's near and dear to us, to everybody. In a man's life, if a man wants to be sexual with a woman, he's got to ask, because women don't ask. If a man wants to, Warren Farrell says there's 150 steps from eye contact to sexual contact. How he gets that, I don't know. But he says there's 150 steps, and men have to take all 150 steps. You know, now the women can let a man know when she's available, you know, wearing certain things or acting a certain way. But a man can pick that clue up and take risk the fact that he could be wrong. Therefore, it forfeits, you know, anything else. But if you want to understand men, one of the things that you need to understand for men is that all of these feelings go into play in dealing with women in terms of asking and initiating sex. Our role is to be the initiator. Some people are petrified by rejection. you know, and you get strange men who will do anything to lower their risk of rejection. Some men are very awkward about it. Some men make a joke of it, you know. I had a friend of mine who used to tell me that if you want a woman, you need to ask about 10 of them, sort of make a game of it, you know, to get one woman.
Question for you. What if you only want one woman?
Well, then you ask. Yeah, but you still got to ask. You but still got to. You still got to. Say that again.
If they're not there, then what do you do with all those other steps?
If they're not there, then you don't have. What, I don't understand. What are you saying?
Never mind. Go ahead.
No. Okay. So this is kind of a key point to. To understanding, some men think the whole thing is dumb. Some think it's on the spot. All they feel like they're on the spot. All of this stuff goes into play in terms of male-female relationships. But the one thing that all men know that they have to do is to initiate anything sexual with a woman. Hence, you get men who don't listen. Women say all the time, why don't men listen? Well, one reason men don't listen is because if they listen too close, they may hear a rejection. And so oftentimes, no, we don't listen because we don't want to, if we get a yes, we don't want to, somewhere down those 150 steps, get a no. You know, so we kind of forge ahead. And then you get this. The catch-22 of sexuality. The catch-22 is that men must ask for sex. Men must initiate sex. But in our culture, sexuality is kind of dirty, you know? So men have to initiate something that's dirty. And so after a man initiates something that's dirty, then you know, he has to be the one that bears the brunt of, you know, oftentimes men are looked at as, you know, animals. Well, if you're doing the initiating, it's easy to see why you would come across as an animal, because you're asking for what you want. Kind of a and the catch-22, another catch-22 part is that, so in order to have sex, you need to pretend like you're not interested in sex in order to get sex. You know, because women are offended if you're too interested in sex. So you pretend like you're not interested in sex in order to get sex. So that's one thing. I'll go through all of these and then we'll do question stuff if you have. I know something. There are several definitions of power, but one definition of power is the ability to control your own life and the ability to be lovable, to appear lovable to people. When we played this game, some people felt, you know, asking for money was kind of a dirty thing or something that's just you just don't do. So that would, you know, that gets in the way of lovability. And then you get into the power thing. Men have been told for years that we have the power. But when you look at it from this perspective, you know, number one, who has the power? Number two, there is a female experience of power and a female experience of powerlessness. There are male experience of power and male experiences of powerlessness. And in terms of being sexual, males experience powerlessness. Then we get to the nine conditions. A man's one condition and a woman's nine conditions for intimacy or sex. Men have been trained by society, basically. You know, if a woman's attractive, that's all a man needs. But for some men, that's all some men want. And then, you know, you get varying degrees where most people want respect, emotional stability, maturity, that kind of thing, intelligent, the person should be single. But then women add this onto it. And this is something that most men don't add onto it. Status, success, he must ask her out, he must pay, he must risk rejection. Hence, men are suggested as success objects. Oftentimes, men have to be successful or have the potential of being successful before women are even interested in them. He tells this story of men who sit and watch women go by and say, oh, look at that, you know, that kind of thing. But a man walks by and women say, look at the wallet on that guy, you know. So for a man to be intimate with a woman, a lot of it depends on his wallet, so to speak. He must be able to pay for that affection. And then you get into the three P's, which is pursue, pay, and perform, or pursue, perform, and pay. Oftentimes, men must perform in order to get women's attention and women's affection. You know, athletics is full of that. You know, he mentions football a lot in the sense that why on earth would anybody want to get their face smashed in? One reason why so many boys are willing to get their faces smashed in is that, number one, they get female attention. They have women on the sidelines jumping around and cheering for them. One woman put it this way, that football is the ultimate in hunting and gathering societies. A bunch of hunters chase a pig, and the one who gets the pig gets the win. Hence, to start a family. So, you know, he's got to prove that he can hunt before women will allow him to be intimate with them. Hence, men marry down, women marry up. Women marry men who have either more than they do or the potential of making more. Men marry down because most women aren't interested in a man who has less than they have. In fact, we have a nice little word for women who marry men who have just the same or less than they have, and that's called settling. Settling. When a woman reaches middle age, I remember my parents talking about it, and she can't find Mr. Right, she settles. Meaning, she marries a man who is a janitor or whatever. Somebody who doesn't have the potential for bringing in large bucks. Also, men are oftentimes unpaid bodyguards. Men are oftentimes, you know, you hear a squeak in the middle of the night, and the man gets up with the flashlight and goes down to see what's going on. As an African-American man, as a large African-American man, I walk in downtown Seattle, and I oftentimes see a man will be walking with his family or his girl or woman, and if I come by, the man will cross over and put his body in between me and the children and the wife or the, you know. I see this a lot, and men just automatically do that. So we're automatically unpaid bodyguards. And then we get into fantasies. A man's primary fantasy is to have sex with an assortment of women. A woman's primary fantasy is for security and to basically to marry up. And one of the telltale signs of this is porn. We all know what male porn is. You know, it's an assortment of women. You get to watch an assortment of available women. Female porn, on the other hand, are romance novels, where this hunk of a man who pledges his undying love and fidelity to a woman and is willing to die for her or kill for her. And you see that in romance novels, which sell buku, and you see that also in soap operas. Soap operas are full of attractive young women falling in love with doctors, attorneys, lawyers, the whole thing. Female porn is acceptable. You know, a woman can sit on a bus or anywhere at Holden Village and sit and read a romance novel. Male porn is not. So, that's where we have it. So, at this point, I'd like to leave it open for discussion. And you're dying to say something. You want to?
No.
No, you're not?
No, I can just hardly. This room looks like it's about to explode. I can hardly wait to hear it.
You know, your term unsettling?
Uh-huh.
There's a great movie on that called Crossing Delancey.
Ah, The Pickle Man.
The Pickle Man. She settles for The Pickle Man.
Yeah. Our movies are just...
Wonderful movies.
Yeah, movies really reflect what we think about that sort of thing. Oftentimes in a movie, women get upset, you know, when a woman gets killed or stalked and killed. Mm-hmm. But also in a movie, the main character may kill 20 men before he revenges that, you know, that one man who attacked the woman, you know. But that's not the point. That's not what people get worked up about. But movies is loaded with stuff about men who save and rescue, good-looking men who save and rescue, and who money's no object, that kind of thing.
About football,
mm-hmm.
I know there are a lot of women, and I'm one of them, that I do not look up to football. I do not enjoy watching football. I do not enjoy the mentality of football. And I don't sit on the sidelines cheering for people playing football. I don't watch football on television. And I have a real problem with the way it puts men and women in the situations you're talking about.
Well, it's not just football. Okay?
Well, it does, like, in high school, it totally does.
Yeah.
And that just sets the route for a lot of kids.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's our society that reflects our sport or our sport reflects our society. But maybe.
Yeah. But it's not, football is kind of a symbol. It's a very you know, everybody knows what football is. But it's the ability to perform anything. You know, if you read biographies of people, I like reading biographies of old movie stars. My mother got me hooked on that. And you read the biography on people like Clark Gable, Bing Crosby, Bob Hope. Those men had endless supply of women. You know, I mean, those men slept with, we're talking thousands of women, you know. And it's the same, you know, today with football stars, basketball stars, the wannabes that hang around them. Now, the thing is that you say, you know, I know people think, well, you know, just because somebody is a movie star or whatever, you know, sex is so shallow and all of that kind of stuff. Women say that for sure, but there are thousands of women who are willing to hook up with these men when you have people who say, like, a man who washes dishes or is a janitor, he certainly doesn't have access to thousands of women. So, you know, it has a lot to do with the ability to perform, but also pay, pursue, perform.
I was going to say, I've watched it also, having worked in a theater or in a roadhouse, you watch a road show come in, and it's so easy for people with names to go out and just pick up bevies, and I wish it weren't so, but it is.
I'm not saying it isn't, I'm just saying that there are women
that don't.
Yeah, oh yeah, there are women who don't. I'm not saying that this is across the board, especially here at home, and I know you are exception. But all of your friends and relatives and of that sort. I see this hand and I see this one. We'll go with this one first.
Okay, we're talking about rejection or fear of rejection.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like remember you just talked about the people who are the dishwashers or whatever, the non-important people. How are they going to go, you know, the cultural amount of, well, men in general, anyway, maybe I just thought, I'm a man, I have a fear of rejection. You know, I was talking first person here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where that comes from, our culture. Where does that come from? Why are we so afraid of rejection? I mean, it's not so much, it's one thing to ask and get rejected. It's another thing, well, I'm not going to even ask because I don't want to get rejected.
Well, it comes from being rejected. I mean, if you like somebody, you know, if you like a woman, and you pursue her and she rejects you, then you know what that is. So you compensate for it. Some men compensate for it by making a game of it, asking 10, 15 women, you know, mm-hmm. and just, you know, not ever giving their heart away anymore. Some men compensate for it by not asking anybody anymore, you know, and they sit up and watch junk food and, you know, let their prostate rot. Yes, sir.
You were talking a lot of stereotypes, and that's obviously, I think, as you mentioned, the history of this particular individual who wrote the book, going from Mao to this book, he seems to have swung to the other extreme. There is also the situation where, I mean, you're saying that these men are sleeping with lots of women.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they getting all these women? These women are also sleeping with lots of men. And you can turn this around in many ways, but the statistics may be more heavily weighted in the male side, and that might definitely fall into your argument. My question is, what are you trying to say with this, as far as...
Well, one thing, what I'm trying to say is that men, I mean, a lot of women simply don't understand why men do what they do. And this is to give people insight, and men as well, because some men don't talk to other men, you know. Men as well, insight into what goes on. There are men who die and never understand women. Never understand what women want from them or what they're supposed to do in that situation, and vice versa. And I think this stuff lays that out. I do not think this is stereotypical. I think that this is reality for a lot of people. You know.
That's statistical. Yeah.
What? Is there a man in this room who hasn't been rejected? Is there a man in this room who hasn't lost a woman to a football star or somebody who makes more money or somebody who has more of the show? I mean, raise your hands if you have.
I think as far as rejection, I've been rejected one time. I think that...
one time.
The one time that really sticks out in my mind, because it was a really long relationship and I was hoping that it could move into marriage, but I think it was a fact of I just didn't know, looking at my own end of it, I didn't know how to love. I really didn't know. I didn't have the skills as far as expressing my emotions, expressing my innermost feelings, and really and expressing my love for this woman, like, I, you know, at that time. But I don't know. As far as she didn't reject me for another person. She rejected me because I think it just didn't work. I don't know how else to describe it, but.
Well, you know, I have a question. How many people have read this book, the one he's talking about? What is it called again?
Why Men Don't Read the
Odyssey. I read the book, and you know, I got something completely different than you did out of that book. Because what I got out of that book was why men are the way they are has a lot to do with all the media and all the stimulus they receive that encourages them to be like those stereotypes. And for me, it wasn't that there are men, more and more men are becoming that way, but that we have to understand why they got that way so that we can change it. And well, you know, there are lots and lots of women who've been rejected, I mean, and who have lost a man.
I'm not, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that women haven't been rejected. I'm giving this from the male perspective.
True, you are.
This is called Why Men Are the Way They Are.
But
I'm in no position to say why women are the way they
are.
But you read the book and you were a woman.
True.
So quite naturally, you wouldn't get out of the book what I got.
True. But you know what I got out of the book, not just from a male perspective, though, from a woman, because that's what I happen to be, that it was why men and women in American society are the way we are has so much to do with the bombardment we always get, we get so constantly with the media, you know, with the movies that you described and the books and the magazine covers.
Well, does this mean you think that a few generations ago it wasn't like this?
No. Not at all. Oh. I'm saying that the media that we have is continuing and perpetuating,
exacerbating
and perpetuating the problem that men have and women have these stereotypes.
Let's yes and no, you know, because I've read articles that this is very primitive stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that you know, women needed to choose a partner who was going to be there for the caring of the child. But also, when women are pregnant, they're helpless. You know, they can't.
Aww.
I mean, when we're talking primitive life, they're helpless. They can't defend themselves against attackers. They can't defend their children against attackers. And so they need a male presence. So this is primitive stuff. This is in the animal kingdom. This was in our primitive society. A lot of this stuff is just in our DNA, you know. So
can we rise above our DNA?
Yeah, I don't know. Can we? He talks about, later on in the week, I'll get into more of his stuff. This is kind of just a primer, but he talks about that we have, there's two stages. There's stage one and there's stage two. Stage one is survival. That's the purpose of stage one living. Stage two is fulfillment. And he says our society is moving towards fulfillment. And one of the reasons that a society moves towards fulfillment is because number one, it is protected. Number two, there's enough food, and number three, there's enough water. And when those conditions are met, many societies become safe societies. He talks about the Vikings, who were absolute killers. But then when they got in a position, you know, like today, who thinks of Danes and Swedes as killers? You know? So, you know, a lot of this stuff is, this is primitive stuff. This is not just 1994 stuff. So.
Well, I don't know whether, accepting that to some extent this is true, at least on a statistical basis, I don't know whether it's biological or cultural in its causes, but you look at the women who are following around football teams and sleeping with football stars and whatnot, the stereotype I think of is not a 30-year-old PhD. It's more likely a 21-year-old groupie of some sort. I think that people have a fairly unique ability to be civilized and overcome some of this through civilization.
87% of women who are in corporate America marry up. So that need to marry up is still there. It doesn't matter if you're a groupie or if you're a corporate worker in terms of women.
the tendency is to marry.
No, I mean, there can be entirely different interpretation of that, though. Men in this society tend to have much higher incomes than women. Men can go out and search for the highest incomes they can get. They're still probably not going to make as much as they do. So this works both ways. Men are marrying the best incomes they can, perhaps. The fact that women are marrying up, I think, is a statistical artifact of the fact that women do not make as much money as men.
There's a jacket cover say on the book about net worth. It's not about the women having greater net worth, even though the men make more money.
Men make more money, but men have a lot more responsibilities of what to do with that money. When two people marry,
then they die off and leave it to the women.
When two people marry, if both people are working, the man with his, Women have three options in terms of life. Men have one. Women have three options. They can work. They can work part-time and take care of the children, or they can stay home and take care of the children. Men can work.
Do you think that's always, that women have three options?
I mean, not always. You know, a lot of it depends on social economic status. But men do not have the option. You can talk to, a 15-year-old guy and ask him, does he ever, boys know at a certain point that they're going to work. You know, there's never a point where men know, where men say, well, I'm not going to, when I reach 25 or 30, I'm not going to work. I'm going to stay home and look after the kids.
That simply is
not an option.
They can't. They choose.
They can if they choose to. Yes.
The woman marries down.
But I'm saying, if they choose to, what happens?
That's what happens.
Their wife has to be a corporate worker for them to make a living. You know. So it's a money thing. Men make more. Say it again.
Job sharing.
Those are nice, unique things, but generally, people don't job share.
You expect men to work more. I mean, you wouldn't expect, it's not the norm.
Yeah, it's not the norm. You expect men to work more.
Well, where this really hits me is that I know from high school, from college, and in my single life, I had an absolute fear of rejection. I could not spend a weekend at a time when I wanted to be with a woman, and I didn't have to go through that fear of rejection. So that speaks powerfully to me. The other thing about that is it makes me wonder about that other end of the spectrum of those guys that seem to be habitually going after women. You know, how does that rejection, I mean, how are they caught up in that? I mean,
Well, guys who habitually go after women, it depends. I don't know if they get them or not. it becomes a game. I've known, several guys who were womanizers, and it was indeed a game.
Yeah.
You know, they'd go to a bar or wherever and start talking to a woman, and they'd hit on her. If that didn't work, they'd go take a few seats up and hit on another one, you know? I mean, it becomes a game for them.
It's like gambling.
Yeah.
It's an addiction.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's an addiction. If you want to.
The more successful, the bigger the wallet looks.
Say it again.
And the more successful, the bigger the wallet looks.
Yeah, I guess. I
was just gonna say, as far as the man working it, yeah, you're probably right that as far as that goes, that's a good stereotype because I was trying to think of all of the couples that I know. I know one couple where the man takes care of their son. They have an adopted son, and then the wife, she works. She's got a really good job with the Food and Drug Administration, and they've moved a couple times because of her being transferred. So in that case, was probably marrying down the woman.
Well, let me get something straight for you now. Society has roles for people to play. There's a role for men to play. There's a role for women to play. Whoever doesn't live up to those roles, there's hell to pay. You know, so if a man doesn't live up to his role as provider, you know, he's going to get teased, he's going to be dismissed, whatever. If a woman does not live up to her role as mother and nurturer, she's going to be teased, she's going to be dismissed. You know, so, you know, so there is this, it begins with society says, this is how it should be. This is how men should be. This is how women should be.
Well, our president doesn't even show that stereotype.
Say it again?
Our president doesn't show that stereotype.
Well, yeah, he doesn't show that stereotype. But, you know, you have to say to yourself, Hillary Clinton is, she has a powerful position. But the reality is that Hillary Clinton did not run for anything. She did not go from city to city, right, having to shake hands with thousands of people, having to be a target maybe for an assassin's bullet. She was by his side, but she didn't have to press the flesh. She didn't have to stand up and put her beliefs on the line and have headlines laugh at her or denounce her or whatever.
Well, there's a reinforcement on that that I saw on a bumper sticker that it said, impeach the president and Bill too.
So, to this date, other than one, only one woman has ran for president, got out and pressed the flesh, and did what you have to do for one to run for president. Who knows who that was?
Shirley Chisholm.
Shirley Chisholm.
Oh, that's right.
Geraldine Ferraro. She ran for vice president on Mondale's ticket. You know, so. You know, I'm saying that to say that this role thing still exists. I mean, the men had to get out there and work and beat the bushes. The women came along with the men.
It's all very hard to take. I'm resonating actually with what you're saying, that this is real true and have gone through discussions. I'm, 35? So... actually the generational difference is kind of intriguing to me between what my parents and me and then people who may be, another 10 or 15 years younger than me, the difference in experience or expectation. But I know that among the men I know who are my friends or with whom I have been involved, we've talked about this. And if at times we've ever come up to the idea of doing something different, of stepping out of those roles, it was a serious discussion. It was not something we couldn't entertain, but it was a serious discussion. And I remember once a discussion I was in with a man I was involved in quite seriously, and we got into discussion of, he was in school and going for a PhD and I was working at the time. And suppose we were to be married, and I was bringing in the paycheck and he was not, and how would we react to that? Now, he had been married previously, and boy, that had been explosive in that marriage. And when we talked about it, what I finally had to say to him was, I could do it, and it would be all right. We could do that, but don't think that I wouldn't have to deal with my own reactions to breaking the role model. I would be having serious gut problems. Even if I had said, this is okay, and we decided to go into stage two and consciously say, I'm going to break out of the role and do something different, I would still have to deal with all these little things going on in my stomach, say, it's not supposed to be this way, it's not supposed to be this way. It would be something seriously to consider, and to ignore that would be to doom the whole thing to disaster.
Society says that, you know, one of the reasons why society is, Pharaoh says that where society is homophobic, is because if a man and a woman have sexual intercourse, there's got to be a commitment there. Generally, they've gone out and the man has bought dinners and paid for movies, and it was his car, so they went in, and, you know. So by the time you get to actually having sex, the man has paid for it, and the man has committed to that relationship. But, you know, if homosexuals have sex, you know, it's just 2 hours, whatever, 2 hours, I'll say, 2 hours of pleasure, in a sense, but if, you know, you didn't have to go through, and I'm not saying that gay people are not committed. What I'm saying is that
heterosexuals are jealous.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what he says. You know, heterosexuals are jealous because there's sexual activity just for the plain sake of sexual activity.
But you're saying that by the man paying for all that, the woman is nothing more than a prostitute.
Well, that's the dark side of women. The dark side of men is that men are, you hear feminists say it all the time, that men are rapists. All men are rapists. The dark side of women is that all women are whores. You know, and when you talk to people in bars who are very base and angry, you know, they will say that, you know, that very thing. The potential for a woman to take advantage of a man financially is always there. The potential for a woman to be intimate with a man for financial reasons is always there. The potential for a man to overpower a woman physically is always there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking about the way things are. I've been wondering about if we evolve to a higher way of living and have developed more self-esteem, more spirituality, you know, you're in a different plane than all this.
Well, yeah, he talks about eventually, I mean, we're getting to that point now where we're going to have to elect a president that is not willing to kill. We're going to have to elect a president who's willing to communicate. Our society is moving in that direction, and that's in his stage two thing, you know. He says in stage one, it was all about survival. You needed a president who would be willing to kill, who would be willing to send young men out to the battlefields to kill. And he says in stage two, you're moving more towards, and our world is set up that way, where you're moving more towards a president. You need a president who can communicate and bargain and, you know, negotiate, as opposed to, you know, going out to war or going out to kill. And he says one of the, number one is that if he doesn't do that, we'll all blow up. But number two, he says, one of the things that perpetuates that is enough food, enough water, and to take away the threat of enemies coming in and taking over.
I have to believe I'm not the only one here who thinks something is missing. And I've been listening, and a lot of this makes sense, goes in and out of focus, but you put it in great perspective when you hit on the word primitive, and then I suddenly realized this whole apparatus that this book contains really is describing the mating process under adverse conditions, under modern conditions. It's the mating process, the primitive process of finding a mate, an acceptable mate for the creation of a family. And this has been corrupted in certain ways, and it's been then it gains all these attributes. But I think there's an equal force also operating. I wouldn't call it the civilized part, but I would call it the human part, which is, whether we acknowledge it or not, men tend not to, but I think men and women are both seeking, there's a drive for affection. At the same time, you know, we have to meet all these requirements you're talking about here, because this is in society, it's in the media, it's in the DNA maybe. All of that apparatus is certainly true, but it doesn't account entirely for my experiences or the feelings I have in the midst of this mix. I think the drive for affection, for reciprocated affection, which maybe that's the distinction between survival and fulfillment, and they're both going on at the same time. There's a desire for some kind of fulfillment, although it does look pretty thin and wan in the male
Well, if there was a war in this country and, you know, things were totally destroyed and you had a choice between a nice conversation and affection and a loaf of bread, which would you go for?
I don't understand the question because
well, the question is, we're never that far away from survival. We're never that far away from plain old survival. We can talk here because we got three meals a day, we have a place to sleep. But you know, you don't have to go too far down the socioeconomic scale before you find people who that is a luxury. For our parents,
I don't think I dispute
that. That is a luxury.
I just want to introduce the notion that perhaps affection is important to them, if that's a them, to everybody.
It's important.
I'm saying equally important, and that's where the internal struggle comes in. The internal strife.
If we have protection, if we have food, if we have water, it's equally important. Yes.
Well, I'll desist. I don't agree with you.
Okay.
I get to hear a couple of things. One of the things that I noticed, being 44, and they talked about the Women's Awareness Week 2 weeks ago, and I thought, when I was 22, we burned the bra, yes! And I said at that time, women's issues were very external. We were looking at Vietnam, a lot of issues like that. Now it seems that women's issues have become much more internal. And that's a major generational difference that I saw. But I also see, when we talk about men, that the Women's Awareness Week was geared toward people who are in the mating age. And after you get past that age and you settle down with somebody you love, the whole picture looks really different. And I think he's really speaking to stereotypes, and he's speaking to people who are in the mating game or who keep themselves in social situations where they keep competing maybe after they're married, even.
Have you, are you familiar with Flint, Michigan?
Yeah. I will be living in Michigan soon.
Have you read anything about Flint, Michigan?
I won't ask if you're
from there. Flint, Michigan in the 1980s, of course, the bottom fell out. And they lost all of their industry stuff. And child abuse skyrocketed. Rape skyrocketed. Families falling apart skyrocketed. You know, I don't think that this is just for people who are mating. You know, because if certain conditions are not met, you know, if you're not in a position, I don't care if a man is rich or, well, that doesn't make sense. I don't care if a man can't afford to do this stuff, you know, his chances of having, you know, a wife, his chances of having children, his chances of taking care of those children, taking care of that wife, his chances of owning a home and taking care of that home is nil. You know?
But the issue is competition. And after I got married, I quit competing. I don't see other women as my competitors. And it's in the same way at all as I tell them as a single woman.
It's not, this applies to mating, but I don't think it only applies to mating. If being a man has to do with your wallet, the fact that you know, one of the things he says is that the way society is built, women get their love from nurturing people. Men's love depends a lot on being able to pay for education, to pay for a house, to pay for clothing, and if you can't pay, you lose. You know, when the money quits coming in the door, the love goes out the window. No money, no honey. Men have heard this from day one.
It's a reality. You look at Flint, Michigan. When 1,000 or 20,000 people got laid off from GM, 100 of them went out and beat their kids. okay? 19,900 of them did not go out and meet their kids. They still have loving family relationships. What you're describing is, at best, the aberrations of a minority, which we can blame on a variety of things.
Do you understand that in major cities, we're talking around 500 African-American men are killed a year. I mean,
right.
killed a year.
Yeah, you know? I don't
know. Hold on, let me finish. One of the things that he says is that one of the things that distinguishes African-American men and Native American men and some Spanish men is that they cannot take care of their families. They cannot protect their families financially.
Extrapolating a bit as far as he was talking economic, social status, not necessarily minorities as human beings.
I know what he was talking about, but I'm saying the statistics are in Flint, Michigan, even if 100 people went out and 19,000 didn't, it was still 99 more than did
right, but
when everybody was working.
But the small percentage that caused that had to be the significant problems were those who were financially strapped. That could be anywhere up and down the social.